WVUA-FM, Tuscaloosa.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Pulse of the Nation, WVUA's new offering. In this podcast, I will be going over all the top political stories over the course of a week. Hi, I'm Braden Vick. I am the host of this podcast, Pulse of the Nation. So for the first episode, I want to discuss three elections that happened, with two major elections happening in the Midwest, one notable election happening there as well. The first one that I want to sort of go over and tell the story of is the election that happened in the Wisconsin, in the state of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Supreme Court election that happened on Tuesday, where a liberal circuit court judge in Milwaukee County, Janet Protasevich, was able to pick up a massive 11-point victory over Dan Kelly, a conservative and former justice of the Supreme Court himself. Many in national media and local media have characterized this, obviously, as a victory for liberals, as it is. Control of the state Supreme Court flips back to the liberals, and now there may be moves made by this new court majority on such topics as abortion, LGBTQ plus issues, and especially rolling back GOP gerrymanders in the state of Wisconsin. But I did want to ask how we got here. How do we get to this point in this situation? Well, you have to go back 21 years. You have to go back to 2002. April 2002, there was a special election that was happening in Milwaukee County for county executive. The past executive had resigned over, I believe, corruption allegations, and an open conservative by the name of Scott Walker was able to win that election. And he was actually able to remain as Milwaukee County's county executive, the top position in the county, until 2010. He was an open conservative, and he got his name out there, national profile, and he ended up running for governor in 2010 under the red wave cycle that happened during those midterms, and he was able to beat Tom Barrett, who was the mayor of Milwaukee, by nearly 6 percentage points to become governor of Milwaukee. And that's where the story kind of starts, the whole Scott Walker machine. The Scott Walker machine is based around the Milwaukee suburbs of the city of Milwaukee, either in southern Milwaukee County or especially in what is termed as the WOW counties, Waukesha, Sauke, and Washington counties, three exurban, suburban counties in Wisconsin that has served as a base of modern conservatism for God knows how long in the state of Wisconsin. And this region is one of the many regions in the state of Wisconsin that I will talk about. Before I go into any further discussion about Walker's tenure as governor or the maps that they're able to pass, so I want to go over the political geography of Wisconsin. So first off, you have, the city of Milwaukee is deeply Democratic. It is a large Black and Hispanic population. It's a much larger Black population, though. There is a growing Hispanic-Latina community in the city as well. Milwaukee County also has more moderate to conservative white suburbs in the south. It has now used to be moderate to conservative, now very liberal white suburbs like Wauwatosa and to the west, and also in areas to the north and east of the city of Milwaukee itself. You have the WOW counties, which I discussed earlier, the bedrock of modern Wisconsin conservatism. You have the Fox Valley, which contains the cities of Green Bay, Oshkosh, I'm sorry if I mispronounced that, and also Appleton. That is a trending left, still a bit conservative, I would say, but not nearly as conservative as WOW, and it's placed in the northeast of Wisconsin. Then you have the Driftless area, which is in the southwest of Wisconsin. It's your classic, Obama-Trump, white working class, rural communities that, will still vote for Democrats down ballot, but a lot of the counties that don't have major cities in them that aren't like La Crosse or Eau Claire have recently voted for Republicans in recent cycles. You have northern Wisconsin. The northern rurals are usually red. You have the northern three counties. You have You have, if I look here, there is a, look here on this map, you have the counties of Douglas, Bayfield, and Ashland. They give Democrats decent margins. Those are three small counties. Then you have some native groups like in Menominee County and the north, generally northeast of the state. But then you also have Madison, and this has become more so the home base of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. And especially around the city of Madison and its growing influence. Madison is one of the most left-wing cities in the country. Definitely one of the most, if not the most, left-wing state capital in the country, regularly giving Democrats margins that you would probably see in elections in Syria. Like, a lot of times these are referred to as Assad margins because of just the ungodly amounts of net votes that Democrats get and the ungodly margins that they are getting in the city of Madison and in Dane County itself. This propels Democrats – this county, this city propels Democrats to victory in Wisconsin nowadays. There is also influence by, you know, Dane County into like nearby Iowa, Greene, Rock County. I mean, Rock County contains the city of Beloit. So, I mean, that has its own influence as well. But sort of like Madison metropolitan area is one of the key factors to Democratic victories in Wisconsin in the contemporary political era. But now back to the Scott Walker story. So in 2011, during Scott Walker's first year as governor, immediately he comes in and he passes a law that is seen by many within labor unions as being detrimental to them. It is seen as anti-union by them, and there are massive protests that are organized in Wisconsin. The state capitol gets occupied in Madison. It gets occupied for a while, and it ultimately the law passes. And it leads to a recall election in 2012. Tom Barrett runs again, the 2010 nominee, the former, that still serving mayor of Milwaukee at that time. And he runs against Walker, and Scott Walker beats him by 7 points. And this gives Scott Walker a national network of support of conservatives, some donors and business groups and organizations and stuff, and you know, stuff like that. But during that same year, there was a state Supreme Court election in 2011. It was a very close race between a pro-Walker juror called David Prosser Jr. and Joanne Kloppenburg, who was a liberal and the assistant attorney general of Wisconsin at the time. And Prosser ended up winning by less than a percent, 0.5 percentage points, because he ended up clearing 40%. In Milwaukee County, thanks to, you know, the more moderate to conservative suburbs, especially in the south of the county. And actually, there was a bit of controversy around the time centered on nearby Waukesha County, because Kloppenburg was actually leading until it was discovered that there were several thousand uncounted votes in the suburb of Brookfield in Waukesha County. Waukesha County being a majorly conservative county, still to this day, their votes ended up being counted, you know, correctly, and it delivered the election to Prosser. And this gave Scott Walker a state Supreme Court majority and the impetus, again, to sign Act 10, that, you know, hotly contested law or bill at that time, into law. He knew that the new conservative majority would likely uphold it, which they did in 2014. At the same time as these protests were happening and then winding down, newly won GOP majorities in the state assembly and the state senate due to the red wave that had happened nationwide, they were massive participants in Red Map, which was aggressively targeting, you know, districts to be won over by Republicans, and there was also a redistricting component to it. And through this, they passed one of the most aggressive gerrymanders in the country that not only would ensure GOP dominance in state politics through pretty much unbreakable majorities in the state assembly and the state senate, but the congressional map was made to be 5-3 in favor of the GOP as well, and both of these would hold throughout the decade. Now, something to know about Wisconsin's redistricting laws for state assembly and state senate maps is that the state senate is one-third the size of the state assembly. The state assembly is made up of 99 districts, the state senate is made up of 33 districts, and each state senate district has to contain three whole state assembly districts. So Wisconsin Republicans were able to fall within the rules and, you know, draw themselves into pretty much unbreakable power in the state legislature. So we're going to go away from that, and we're going to focus now, because there was a lot of state Supreme Court elections. Wisconsin elects their Supreme Court justices to 10-year terms. And in 2013, there was a conservative up called Patience Rogensack, who won re-election by over 15% against a liberal called Ed Falone. Patience Rogensack's name is going to be important to this story, but we'll get to her later. In 2014, Scott Walker was up for re-election, and he was facing a school board member from Madison called Mary Burke. This was a hotly contested election. The polling was really close, but Scott Walker ended up winning by 6 points. 2014 was also famous for its low turnout midterm nationwide. So that's another element that I would want to add. But the next year, in 2015, a liberal-aligned incumbent by the name of Van Walsh Bradley, who identified as a Democrat, even though, of course, you know, Supreme Court justices are technically nonpartisan and run nonpartisan races, she defeated a conservative Rock County Circuit Court judge by the name of James Daly. She won that race by over 16%. If you can't tell, Wisconsin does like their incumbents. But there wasn't a big election. Well, there was a big election in Wisconsin in 2016. There was, of course, a presidential election in 2016, as we all know. And there also was a state Supreme Court election. But first, we'll get through what Scott Walker tried to do. He ran for president in 2016, and he did not do so hot. He endorsed Ted Cruz because he wanted an alternative to Trump. That failed, so he ended up being a debate advisor for future vice president Mike Pence, you know, during the debates with Democratic vice presidential nominee Senator Tim Kaine of the state of Virginia. Trump ended up winning the state of Wisconsin, and Ron Johnson, a Republican, ended up winning a U.S. Senate race in the state of Wisconsin over Democrat and Russ Feingold, flipping that Senate seat to the Republican Party, a Senate seat which Ron Johnson still holds to this day. But little known was another state Supreme Court election, which saw a conservative incumbent by the name of Rebecca Bradley beating liberal opponent Joanne Kloppenburg, who, I mean, if you will recall, ran in 2011 against David Prosser. You know, Kloppenburg lost that race by nearly 5 points. Rebecca Bradley outperformed not just Donald Trump, who won the state by, I believe either around 1 point or less than a point. She outperformed both Donald Trump and Ron Johnson. Ron Johnson, I believe, won Wisconsin by around 3% in 2016, if I remember correctly. Rebecca Bradley's name will be important to tales of the 2020 presidential election, which she was one of the, three justices on the Supreme Court who tried to essentially overturn the results of the election in that state in 2020, which Joe Biden won the state of Wisconsin by less than a percentage point, and with it, it's 10 electoral votes. But that's another story for another time. Right now, what we're focused on is Wisconsin and the state Supreme Court itself. So in 2017, there was technically another state Supreme Court election, but it was uncontested, and incumbent conservative jurist Annette Ziegler ended up winning another 10-year term. But here's where things start to crumble in 2018, because, of course, we all recognize Donald Trump, the incumbent president, was not exactly well-liked by a majority of the public, and still isn't to this day. And this posed a lot of problems for Scott Walker. He was running for re-election. He was putting the Walker machine on the line against Democratic superintendent of public instruction by the name of Tony Evers. And of course, for those who are more politically inclined, you will know that the 2018 election was a blue wave nationwide. Democrats gained a net of 40 House seats. And Scott Walker was not immune to this. Despite putting up his best efforts, he narrowly lost the governorship to Tony Evers. And during that same time, there was a Democratic senator by the name of Tammy Baldwin who was running for a re-election during that time. And she won by 11 points over Leah Fukamir, the GOP's nominee. And Democrats also swept the Roe offices during that time. Attorney General Josh Call won by 0.6% against GOP incumbent Brad Scheimel. But there was also down the ballot another state Supreme Court election. A hardline conservative justice by the name of Michael Gableman was retiring, and Democrats took advantage of the blue wave. Liberals took advantage of the blue wave, and Milwaukee County Circuit Court Judge Rebecca Dallet ended up winning convincingly, waxing conservative Sauk County Judge Michael Scrinock by 11.5 points. I believe she may have been the best performing statewide Liberal candidate. I think she even outran Tammy Baldwin by a little bit. So Democrats got to win a flip there in the state Supreme Court. And there was hope, and there were hopes that, if you'll excuse me for my voice kind of breaking there, they were hoping that they would hold conservatives to a 4-3 majority, which is what they're at this point, in 2019. Because longtime liberal stalwart and former Chief Justice Shirley Abrahamson did not seek re-election. I mean, she was old. She ended up passing away of COVID a year after the fact. And it was a hotly contested race between conservative Brian Hagedorn and liberal Lisa Neubauer. And Hagedorn was able to defeat Neubauer by 0.5 percentage point. He did much better in the rurals than Scrinock did and was able to do just enough to get the victory. Both Hagedorn and Neubauer were judges in the Wisconsin Circuit Court of in the Court of Appeals in District 2, which is based in Waukesha County. Neubauer was chief judge there. She is still a judge within District 2's Court of Appeals. But Hagedorn's win gave conservatives a 5-2 majority, and it was seen as a major win for Scott Walker. Even though Walker was no longer governor, his machine was still able to get his former chief legal advisor into the state Supreme Court, cementing, again, a staunch conservative majority on the Supreme Court. Then comes 2020, and before I get to the presidential election, we need to go over Dan Kelly, because Daniel Kelly is not a no-name in Wisconsin. He was actually an incumbent justice in 2020. He was appointed in 2016 by Scott Walker himself, and he was up for re-election in April. And the liberals, the Democratic-aligned organizations, sort of lined up behind a Dane County judge by the name of Jill Karofsky. And during the primary, Daniel Kelly actually gained a majority of the vote, but Wisconsin's laws state that no matter the results of the primary, the top two candidates advance to the runoff. And so Democrats were able to dodge a bullet there. And Jill Karofsky ended up taking advantage of this as liberals and Democrats were determined to make sure that a 5-2 conservative majority would not hold for the 2020 presidential election cycle, because they were concerned about what would happen if let's say Donald Trump lost the election and didn't take it well. That was one of the motives for it, I would assume. And Jill Karofsky ended up dishing out a 10.5 point beatdown to Dan Kelly, beating him. Dan Kelly was the incumbent. Karofsky ended up winning convincingly. She won the Driftless area in southwest Wisconsin. She won the Fox Valley in northeast Wisconsin as well. And there was now a 4-3 split to conservatives, which ends up being crucial, as I mentioned earlier, because there was a 4-3 vote to uphold the results of the 2020 presidential election in Wisconsin, which Joe Biden, of course, ended up winning narrowly. So Karofsky's election is extremely important to that story as well, but its relation to this race is going to end now, because we're going to move into 2022. And this is still Republicans reaping the rewards of their congressional gerrymander, which is now gone 6-2 to the Republicans. You know, incumbent Democrat Ron Kind retired or did not seek re-election, more technically, in the 3rd District of Wisconsin, which is essentially the Driftless area. It had been a strong Obama district. It was trending towards Donald Trump. I believe it was an Obama-Trump district. And Derek Van Orden ended up winning that election by 3.7 percentage points over Democratic nominee Brad Pfaff. That flipped that congressional district to the Republicans. And meanwhile, in this cycle, as incumbent GOP Senator Ron Johnson beat Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes by a percentage point in one of the closest Senate contests of the cycle, incumbent Governor Tony Evers, the Democrat, ended up getting reelected as governor. That is important to the story I will explain later. He won by 3.4 percentage points over GOP nominee Tim Michaels. And this was in the backdrop of Roe versus Wade being overturned. And that was one of the two main concerns for Wisconsin liberals going into this election. Roe versus Wade had been overturned in the summer. There were indications they were going to overturn it in the spring, with Roe versus Wade being overturned, and that energized, you know, Democrats and liberals and liberal-minded independents to go out and vote for liberal-minded candidates. And there was concerns that Dan Kelly, you know, if he was to win that race and maintain a 4-3 conservative majority, would end up forcing, you know, Governor Tony Evers to force him to follow an old law on the books of Wisconsin. I believe it was made just a couple of years after the state was founded. Like, I think it's back to 1849, pre-Civil War days, that banned abortion in pretty much every case And Attorney General Josh Call was fighting that. He said that Wisconsin would not follow that. But, you know, because of Roe versus Wade being overturned, abortion access was, and I believe still is, extremely limited in the state of Wisconsin. And the liberal Milwaukee County Circuit Court Judge Janet Burisevich made abortion rights a backdrop of her campaign, which I find there to be a bit of a dichotomy between myself and national media, which said that Burisevich's focus on abortion rights and she's running as a politician and not as a judge, and Dan Kelly wanted to attack her for that. But, you know, with judicial races being run as elections and essentially being run as partisan races, even though they're technically nonpartisan, at least in Wisconsin, then you will start to understand why, you know, Burisevich would make such a gesture, especially when Wisconsin has been proven to be a pro-choice state in the past and not exactly anti-abortion in the slightest, especially, you know, in the post-Roe era. And Burisevich was able to ride that. She was able to ride, you know, anger over GOP gerrymanders to a lesser extent to that 11-point win that I had discussed earlier. So Democrats will have a 4-3 majority on the state Supreme Court in August when Burisevich is sworn in. And it is expected that later in the year, you know, there will be lawsuits filed to overturn those GOP gerrymanders of the state assembly, of the state Senate, and of Congress. And those rulings will be expected to probably be handed down in late 2023. But if they do, as expected, overturn those GOP gerrymanders and, you know, order a redrawing of the maps, then it will probably essentially end the U.S. House careers of not just Derek Van Orden of the Driftless area, but it would also end the career of Brian Steele, who represents Wisconsin's 1st District. If, you know, many people that watch this podcast may remember Paul Ryan, who used to represent the area for a long time until he resigned in 2018 because, you know, the blue wave. And I think he was actually concerned he might lose that race to a Democratic candidate. But Brian Steele came in, beat that candidate. He's represented southeastern Wisconsin ever since. But his district might get redrawn to essentially just be the eastern parts of Kenosha and Racine County and, you know, parts of Milwaukee County. And so there are expectations that the congressional map will be redrawn for a 4-4 even split. There are some expectations that Representative Mike Gallagher of, I believe, the 8th District, his district might be made more competitive by taking in Door County in the far northeast of the state on that peninsula, but also taking in the cities of Green Bay, Appleton, Oshkosh, in areas like that to make essentially a Trump by 5-7 district, essentially a likely Republican district. Van Orden's district might be made Biden by 6-8 or something like that. And so not only those two representatives, or potentially three if Gallagher loses a redrawn district in a blue wave or something like that, but also a ton of GOP state assembly and state Senate members might also be drawn, you know, out of their districts and into not really a sort of irrelevance, but into losing their seats, you know, to Democrats. And Democrats are hoping that, you know, with the redrawing of the seats, that they may be able to win, you know, control of one, if not both, you know, both state legislatures. And Governor Evers is especially hoping that Democrats will be able to do so. So that a potential Democratic trifecta in Wisconsin, if it's in mid-decade or late decade, or if it's in 2030, it may be able to enact sort of a Democratic agenda, as the state of Michigan has done, you know, after, you know, 40 years of Democratic politics and liberal politics being on the sort of back burner in statewide politics in Michigan. Now with the new trifecta they've had, they've essentially used those 40 years and have a fast aggressive, you know, legislation in favor of public sector unions, in favor of abortion, and in favor of other Democratic policy interests that have gone on the back burner in Michigan for the past 40 years. So now that we're done with the Wisconsin Supreme Court election, before we get to the other major election, I want to cover the 8th Senate District, which was having a special election. The 8th Senate District in Wisconsin is currently based in the suburbs of Milwaukee, in northern Milwaukee County, you know, Ozaukee County to the north of it, and, you know, parts of Waukesha and Washington County as well. Historically conservative, but in the Trump era, it has been leftward trending. It only went to Donald Trump by 4 points in 2020. And Republican Dan Nodal almost lost the district. He ended up winning it by 1.8% over Democratic nominee Jody Habusinikian. But that's an underperformance from Republicans, which has been a common theme in the special elections in the post-Roe era, whether it was Nebraska's first congressional district, where I believe Mike Flood only won by 5.6% over his Democratic challenger, and I believe a Trump by 13 district or a Trump by 11 district, to what happened in the special election. I believe it was in Virginia's 4th congressional district. It was the one where Jennifer McClellan massively outperformed Joe Biden over the Democrat over Republican Leon Benjamin in the race to succeed the late representatives of Don McEachin, who I believe died of cancer, you know, just a couple of weeks after the new House session had gone into order. And or I believe it we passed earlier this year, there was a special election, McClellan won, and that's how that ended. So there's a full, you know, there's a full seating in the House. But Nodal was able to win. And the important thing about this election, the reason why I'm highlighting it, is that it gives the GOP a supermajority in the state Senate. They don't have one in the state assembly, but there were grumblings, you know, mostly from concerned Democrats, but also from Representative Dan Nodal himself, that Nodal would support impeaching, you know, Janet Protasiewicz. On what grounds? I mean, I assume the grounds are is that, you know, she's a liberal and Nodal doesn't like her. I guess that's what it was. I'm not sure what grounds they would hold to remove her. And, you know, my opinion is shared with the leader of the Wisconsin State Senate Republicans, who said that they are not going to impeach Justice like Protasiewicz. So those concerns that were posted by especially Democrats online are not going to suffice. So now that we've spent 30 minutes talking about Wisconsin, let's hopefully spend another 30 minutes talking about Chicago, because they elected a new mayor on Tuesday. It was a hotly contested race between, you know, more conservative Democrat Paul Vallast and more progressive Democrat Brandon Johnson. Paul Vallast being white, Brandon Johnson being black. And the reason why I emphasize the race of these candidates is because Chicago and citywide elections is incredibly racially polarized. To tell the story of this election, you can't even go back to the first round. You have to go back to 1983 in the election of Mayor Harold Washington over a Republican candidate in 1983, and you saw the incredible racial stratification of voting. White voters went predominantly for Bernard Epton, the Republican candidate, and black voters went for Hale Washington. There were some North Side liberal whites that went for Hale Washington that may have tipped the race to him. But if you ever saw a precinct map or a ward map of the 1983 mayoral election, which you can if you look it up on Wikipedia, you will understand what I'm talking about. So Hale Washington gets selected, who was actually a mentor to one of the other mayoral candidates that ran in the first round but didn't make it to the runoff. We'll discuss him later. But Brandon Johnson ended up winning this election, you know, 40 years later, by a similar margin to Harold Washington, funnily enough, by 3 points. There are a lot of comparisons made to Vallast and Epton and Harold Washington and Brandon Johnson. So Johnson won the black vote very comfortably. I believe it was 80-20 or 85-15, some insane aside margins like that. And Brandon Johnson also won the north side, which is just, you know, North Shore, like Lake Shore, progressive white voters. It's gotten more progressive, more left wing over time. And he won the North Side. He won the South Asian vote, essentially Indian, Pakistani, Bangladeshi, that sort of thing. And what was interesting to me is that Brandon Johnson won the Puerto Rican vote, which essentially is in that area between sort of the west side, which is predominantly black, and the northwest side, which is predominantly white and moderate to conservative. And he also won some Mexican voters in the home base of Chuy Garcia, the, you know, sort of mentee of Harold Washington that I talked about earlier, and Chuy's home base of Pilsen and Little Village. You know, Chuy endorsed Brandon Johnson. We'll get to that in a moment. Paul Vallast won most of downtown, which is predominantly white. He won sort of, you know, that sort of like hugely white area between downtown and the north side, like you had the near north side and areas like that. Those went predominantly Vallast, like 75-25, 80-20, that sort of stuff. He also won the northwestern part of the city, which is predominantly white and predominantly moderate. There are some precincts in the northwest of Chicago that actually voted for Donald Trump, and they gave Paul Vallast Saddam Hussein margins, essentially. He won a lot of these precincts with 80-20, 70-30, 75-25 margins. He also won the area of Mount Greenwood, which is in the southwest of the city. It is home to a lot of police officers and firefighters. He won Chinese voters west of downtown. There's a Chinatown there, and Paul Vallast cleaned up with them. And he also won many Hispanic wards as well, you know, that were outside many Mexican wards, especially the one in the southeast of the city that's predominantly Hispanic Latina, and also those in the southwest of the city as well. But how do we get here? how did we get here? We need to, you know, sort of understand who are these two major candidates that were running in the runoff. So first off, who is Paul Vallis? Well, Paul Vallis has a deep background in education and administration. He was the CEO of Chicago Public Schools from 1995 to 2001. Then he went and became the CEO of the School District of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania from 2002 to 2007. He ended up then becoming the superintendent of the Recovery School District of Louisiana from 2007 to 2011. The Recovery School District is a special school district in Louisiana for essentially sort of what people refer to as failing schools and trying to get those schools back up and get those students back up to where they might need to be. After that four-year tenure, he went to Bridgeport, Connecticut to serve as their public school superintendent from 2012 to 2013 before he transitioned more into politics full-time. But he had a political career before that. After, you know, being the CEO of Chicago Public Schools, he ran in 2002 in the Democratic gubernatorial primary. And he got close to winning that too. He placed second out of three candidates. I think he was only a couple of percentage points off of winning Paul Vallis. He won Cook County as well, which is where Chicago is located in the northeast of the state. But Vallis ended up losing that to then Congressman Rod Blagojevich. Rod Blagojevich is now an ex-con, and, you know, I believe he ended up serving jail time for it as well. He got pardoned by Donald Trump. Blago endorsed Donald Trump, but that's another story for another time. But when I say an Illinois governor is an ex-convict or is a convict, then that's essentially sort of most Illinois governors pre-2010. So there's a checkered history of Illinois politicians and corruption. We'll get to part of that later on because it is connected to the mayoral race. But in the 2010, we'll continue with Paul Vallis' political career. He gave a couple of interviews in 2009, one to the Chicago Sun-Times, which showed that Vallis was floating running for the Cook County Commission presidency as a Republican. He formed an exploratory commission in 2010, but eventually passed on running. In the same year as the Sun-Times interview, he gave another interview, which he described himself as, quote, more of a Republican than a Democrat due to his fundamental opposition to abortion. This is going to be extremely important to the story that I want to tell because this is going to become a major attack from more left-leaning candidates against Vallis. So in 2014, he was tapped by Governor Pat Quinn to be his running mate and be in lieutenant gubernatorial spot against Republican nominee Bruce Rauner. And in that 2014 low turnout cycle, in what was another sort of red wave cycle, Pat Quinn and Paul Vallis lost that race for governor to Bruce Rauner. And also keep this race on your mind. Keep in mind the fact that Vallis was the lieutenant gubernatorial nominee for Pat Quinn, because this is also going to come up in the story of the mayoral race. So Vallis takes a bit of a leave of politics for a little bit, but in 2019, Paul Vallis files to run for mayor to succeed the controversial Rahm Emanuel. So this is not Paul Vallis' first rodeo. He ran for mayor before 4 years ago. So in his campaign, he relied heavily on his record as CEO of Chicago Public Schools and was even endorsed by the Chicago GOP. Yes, there is a GOP in Chicago. Chicago went 81-17 for Joe Biden in 2020. Yes, Republicans in Chicago do exist. Yes, they're more focused on Mount Greenwood and in the northwest of the city. But to Vallis' campaign itself, there was a lawsuit that was filed due to the Vallis campaign sending unsolicited texts to voters. And Paul Vallis ended up finishing ninth of 14 candidates in the first round. He ended up getting 5.5%, well short of the mark to make the runoff. But to be fair, I mean, a candidate could have gotten 20% in that field and gotten first place in the first round. It was so divided. And Paul Vallis eventually endorsed Lori Lightfoot, who was, I believe, president of the Chicago Police Board at the time. And she would eventually wipe the floor with Cook County Commission President Tony Preckwinkle. Like, you know, win every war type of victory, like 75-25 type margins. So that's Paul Vallis's pre-2023 history. Now we're going to go to Brandon Johnson. Who was he? Well, he was a social studies teacher at a couple of elementary schools in Chicago, one elementary school and I believe a college prep school, who became an organizer with the Chicago Teachers Union in 2011. The following year, he helped organize the teacher strike that happened in Chicago the following year that was sort of beset by demands for more funding in arts, music, and gym programs and less for sort of high-stakes testing. This is a contrast to what Paul Vallis was focused on while CEO of Chicago Public Schools. Vallis focused on high-stakes testing and getting more standardized tests in the schools. So Brandon Johnson, you know, was a CT organizer, but his political career didn't start until 2018, where he challenged an incumbent Cook County commissioner by the name of Richard Boykin to his left. And this is in the first district, which is more – this is more like, west side Chicago. And Brandon Johnson ended up winning that district very narrowly, though, less than a percentage point over Richard Boykin due to endorsements from the Chicago Teachers Union and – from the SEIU, another major union player in Chicago, but also from a progressive organization, Our Revolution, which is tied to Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, the only open democratic socialist in the United States Senate. In 2019, going over to the Cook County Commission, Brandon Johnson's Just Housing Ordinance, which banned property owners or landlords from inquiring about or considering a tenant's home buyer's criminal history, it passed into law. He was a prominent supporter of a teacher strike that was happening the very same year and of Commission President Tony Preckwinkle's mayoral run the same year. In the county commission, he has been described as an ally of Tony Preckwinkle, who is described as, you know, generally progressive. And there were rumors of him running for mayor in 2019, but he is like a future mayoral bid, but he essentially laughed them off. Oh, 2019, Brandon Johnson knew what he'd be in for 4 years later. He was reelected to the Cook County Commission in 2022. But now we get to 2023, and there were a lot of candidates like there was in 2019. Not 14 candidates, but there were 9 candidates. There are 5 major candidates. There was Paul Vallis. There was the incumbent mayor, Lori Lightfoot. Lori Lightfoot being the first black female mayor of Chicago, the first openly queer mayor of Chicago as well. There was also the aforementioned Chuy Garcia, who is a representative in the U.S. House of Representatives. And he is generally described as a progressive. There's also Brandon Johnson. But there was also Willie Wilson. We're going to get to Willie Wilson eventually. He is an absolute character. But there are also 4 candidates who I would describe as no-hopers. They're Cam Buckner, Sophia King, Jamal Green, and Roderick Sawyer. I believe Buckner, King, and Sawyer were all aldermen in the and what is essentially Chicago's version of a city council. It's called the Board of Aldermen. I believe a lot of Midwestern cities like St. Louis calls the city councils the Board of Aldermen. But Jamal Green was seen as more of a progressive, like Black Lives Matter activist. And those 4 candidates I call no hopers because they had no hope of getting to the second round. And interestingly enough about Roderick Sawyer, his dad, Eugene Sawyer, succeeded Harold Washington when Harold Washington unexpectedly died in 1987, I believe it was. And Eugene Sawyer became the second ever black mayor of the city of Chicago. So it's an interesting tidbit about, you know, the dad of Roderick Sawyer, whether Roderick will ever go to the same heights his dad did, that is up for future considerations. So let's go over the 2023 first round race itself. So Paul Vallis centered his campaign on his education record, but also in balancing the budget and crime, especially crime. He made crime the center point of his campaign. He campaigned on hiring and retaining more police officers, particularly in regards to Chicago Transit Authority and the mass transit in the city. And he also focused on prosecuting misdemeanors. He attacked the Cook County State's Attorney's Office as sort of discarding or disregarding looting and violence that was happening in Chicago. as Paul Vallis was the only non-Hispanic white candidate in the race. He was sort of memed as the hashtag Great White Hope because it was expected he would dominate with white voters, which he ultimately did. Brandon Johnson campaigned on, you know, funding public schools. He wanted to raise $1 billion in new revenues through taxes. And he was the only candidate out of the nine to oppose hiring more cops. He instead wanted to attack what he called the root causes of crime. And he promised to hire more detectives, fund mental health facilities, to give summer jobs for sort of troubled youth, and especially a progressive and socialist favorite agenda called treatment, not trauma. That's a campaign that seeks to reopen shuttered mental health clinics and remove police from responding to mental health crises, replacing them with health professionals. This is especially relevant in the context of this sort of revitalization of the Black Lives Matter movement that happened after the death of George Floyd. And a sort of spark of conversation, especially amongst left circles, about alternatives to policing. If you wonder where, you know, defund the police or abolish the police comes from, then that's sort of it. And treatment, not trauma, comes from that same reaction to the death of George Floyd, the deaths of Breonna Taylor, Rayshard Brooks, and other figures. And the police union, the Fraternal Order of Police in Chicago, will obviously hate Brandon Johnson. And I use hate, I do not use that lightly. And we'll get to that later. Brandon Johnson was not afraid of attacking anybody. He attacked Lori Lightfoot. And Lori Lightfoot responded by saying that Brandon Johnson would never become mayor of Chicago. I wonder how Mayor Lightfoot currently feels, seeing as earlier today she met with, you know, Brandon Johnson to go over the sort of transition of power. Brandon Johnson had attacked Chuy Garcia as, quote, having abandoned the progressive movement. We'll get to that in a little bit. He attacked Paul Vallis for, quote, leaving schools without the necessary support to succeed. As I'll get to later, there's a bit of a conflict between Johnson being a public school teacher and Vallis being the CEO of Chicago Public Schools. Brandon Johnson, once people realized that, oh yeah, he's not some no-hoper, he can literally make the runoff, Mayor Lori Lightfoot heavily attacked him as he rose in the polls. And as we'll get to later, this did not work. Now we get to Lori Lightfoot. Before she ran for mayor in 2019, she was president of the Chicago Police Board, which is an oversight agency trying to oversee the Chicago Police Department. She was appointed there by Mayor, I believe, Richard Daley, before 2019 mayoral run. So she ran for mayor as essentially a political newcomer. She got a groundswell of support from a multiracial background to win the Chicago mayoral race, especially in the second round. She won by nearly 50 points. But as mayor, she did everything in her power to alienate every interest group under the sun. She alienated conservatives. She alienated moderates. She alienated progressives. She alienated socialists. She alienated Italians. Well, if you want to look up, you know, some of the comments that Lori Lightfoot has said that I cannot repeat, you know, in a WVUA broadcast, but if you, you know, if you look up biggest blank in Chicago, then you'll understand what I'm saying. And she also cussed out an alderman by the name of Raymond Lopez, who was attacking her over her response to Black Lives Matter from the right. You know, she was also criticized by socialists and aldermen from the left over a response to Black Lives Matter. Like, if y'all remember, like, when the bridges were raised up so that, you know, protesters couldn't get to another area, that's sort of what that's referring to. And because of alienating everyone under the sun, she came into the election with a sub 30% approval rating. She was hoping that the black vote would power her into the runoff. Yeah. Yeah, we'll get to that later. We'll get to the reason why that didn't happen later, too. It rhymes with Schmelly Pilsen. But now we get to Chuy Garcia before we get to the other guy. Chuy Garcia, as I mentioned before, he was an ally of Harold Washington while he was in the city council way back when in the 80s. Like, Chuy Garcia has been a politician for a long time. He was the first Mexican-American member of the Illinois State Senate in the 90s, and then in 2010, he became a Cook County Commissioner. He didn't serve with Brandon Johnson, though. He became a U.S. House member in 2018, I believe, to replace the outgoing Luis Gutierrez, and that same year Brandon Johnson got in the Cook County Commission. Now, Chuy Garcia was hoping to mobilize Latina voters and some progressives to get himself into the runoff. And this wasn't even his first run. In 2015, he ran for mayor and got to the second round against incumbent Rahm Emanuel. But Rahm Emanuel ultimately won because Rahm Emanuel ended up winning the black vote. But the problem with Chuy Garcia is that he waffled about running for mayor for so long that progressive and leftist organizations and elected officials got so tired of him waiting that they ended up endorsing Brandon Johnson instead. And another problem for Chuy Garcia to be compounded with, even though he was going to get Kim Jong-un margins amongst the Latina community, especially those of Mexican descent, he was attacked by Lori Lightfoot because it turns out that he got political donations from disgraced crypto boy Sam Bankman-Fried. If you understand, he got arrested in the Bahamas. I think he was extradited to the U.S. He's facing a good bit of time in jail. But Chuy Garcia was also linked to illegal activities by another one of those corrupt Illinois politicians I was referring to earlier, House Speaker Mike Madigan, for involving power company Commonwealth Edison, which provides power to all of Chicago and nearly all of northeastern Illinois. And so essentially Lightfoot was attacking Chuy Garcia as being corrupt. Unfortunately for Chuy Garcia, there is a national phenomenon of Latino voters disproportionately turning out less than most other racial or ethnic groups in the United States. So Garcia ended up finishing fourth behind Mayor Lori Lightfoot. And while Mayor Lori Lightfoot endorsed no one in the runoff, Chuy Garcia ended up endorsing Brandon Johnson, which I believe is a reason why Brandon Johnson won Pilsen and Little Village, even though Paul Vallis won most other, predominantly Mexican areas of Chicago. So now we get to the fifth place candidate in the race, Willie Wilson. Willie Wilson is, by all definitions of the phrase, a strange fish. And I believe saying that he's a strange fish is putting it a bit lightly. So he started out as a McDonald's worker. He ended up climbing up the McDonald's ladder to own and operate five different franchises. He owns a company called Omar Medical Supplies, and he helps produce Sing Station, which is a nationally syndicated gospel music radio station. Willie Wilson voted for Donald Trump in 2016, even though we'll get to why this is especially weird later. He came out against the Obergefell versus Hodges ruling the year prior in 2015. When he was still a Democrat. Which Obergefell versus Hodges, for those who don't know, is the ruling by the Supreme Court that effectively legalized same-sex marriage nationwide. He changed his mind on both a few years later. He said, I believe it was in 2018, he said, never again would I vote for Donald Trump. And he also said that he had changed his mind about gay marriage. He said he wanted to reach out and learn about queer issues. He said he was learning, essentially, because he said, coming from the South, he was born in a small town in Louisiana called Gilbert. He couldn't understand, being gay or being queer, but he said he wanted to learn. But, of course, this was not Willie Wilson's first rodeo either. He ran for mayor twice before in the past two Chicago election cycles. In 2015 and 2019, he ended up finishing third in 2015, fourth in 2019. So he finished fifth in 2023. He's going to ultimately end up finishing sixth in 2027 and seventh in 2031, and you get the point. So the reason why I say his endorsement of Donald Trump was weird in 2016 is that he ran for president in 2016 as a Democrat. Unfortunately for him, that went less places than Martin O'Malley's campaign, which also went nowhere. He was not done with politics there, of course. So he ran for Senate in 2020 under the Willie Wilson Party. he created his own party that ran for Senate against Republican Mark Curran and Democratic incumbent Dick Durbin. He won over more moderate to conservative black voters in Chicago. He got the endorsement of the Fraternal Order of Police, and he won literally no one else over. He ended up finishing a distant third. But that story doesn't end there, because before the 2020 Senate run, he organized gas giveaways and food donations during COVID, which has essentially been mocked for years as sort of Willie Wilson bribing people to vote for him through these, you know, gas giveaways and food donations. So his 2023 run focused on essentially being the black Paul Vallis on crime. He was focused on anti-corruption. He attacked Lori Lightfoot as being corrupt. But he also essentially tried to run to the right of Paul Vallis on crime, which is pretty hard to do when Paul Vallis is endorsed by the police union. He wanted to remove all regulations from the Chicago Police Department, Willie Wilson did. He said he wanted to take the handcuffs off of the police and put them on the criminals. Wilson said that anybody who was running away from the police should be hunted down like rabbits, which obviously did not go down too well with, you know, anybody left of center in most people left of center in the city of Chicago. But the reason why Willie Wilson's candidacy is so important and why I call it a major candidacy, not just because he eclipsed 10% in the first round, was because he cost Lori Lightfoot a spot in the runoff. Because Willie Wilson was the second most preferred choice of black voters. Lori Lightfoot was first, you know, Willie Wilson was second, Brandon Johnson was third in the first round. And Willie Wilson's vote would have predominantly gone to Lori Lightfoot. And this is why it is widely thought that Willie Wilson's candidacy cost Lori Lightfoot a spot in that runoff. If that 10% was not bound to a candidate in Willie Wilson, they would have largely gone for Lori Lightfoot, and she would have finished a comfortable second place ahead of Brandon Johnson, and she'd have been in the runoff with Paul Vallis. Willie Wilson, for all that's worth, he ended up endorsing Paul Vallis after getting... And he met with both mayoral candidates, Vallis and Johnson, and ended up endorsing Vallis. Now, I said that we would revisit Vallis's 2009 interviews. Well, this is why, because in the 2023 runoff, Brandon Johnson blasted Vallis as an anti-abortion Republican. You know, and he didn't just say this, Vallis is more conservative than he is, and Chicago is a city that went from Biden by 64 points in 2020. No, because it was revealed, you know, partially during the first round, partially during the runoff, that Paul Vallis on right-wing talk radio had made some disparaging comments, not just against now President Joe Biden, but then President Barack Obama, which is a cardinal sin, especially in the city of Chicago, especially in the state of Illinois, given that's where Obama had his political career start. And also central to this conversation was Paul Vallis's links to Awake Illinois. Awake Illinois is a far-right organization, which is anti-trans, anti-critical race theory, sort of in the at the forefront of sort of, you know, right-wing, you know, activism, particularly in schools in the state of Illinois. A side note about Awake Illinois: they ran a bunch of candidates across the state during the during Tuesday's elections, and they lost pretty much every single race. I think they were, last time I checked, they were only leading in one race in a Chicago suburb exurb. Like, they even lost in Quincy, Illinois. They got swept in Quincy, Illinois. Which is in the western part of the state, Quincy is. It went for Donald Trump by, I believe, around 50 points. So if you're getting swept there, if you're a right-wing organization and your candidates are getting swept in Quincy, then it might be time, I believe, to rethink this whole situation. So Paul Vallis spoke at an event there, which is why I bring in Wake Illinois to the conversation, because Paul Vallis is a champion of school choice, and so is Awake Illinois. Vallis spoke about, you know, the need to be pro-school choice. And this leads into, there were to the two chief divides that I think were present throughout the race. You know, Paul Vallis was an administrator of Chicago Public Schools, and Brandon Johnson was a teacher in there. And if you ask a Chicago progressive or a Chicago socialist, they will bring up the Marxist trope that, you know, essentially it's sort of class warfare on an electoral stage, they will tell you. You know, they'll say this is a fight between, you know, the people and the bosses and all the other shticks that, you know, they usually throw around. And of course, Johnson supported, you know, funding public school and the arts. Vallis supported, sure. Vallis had a record of opening and supporting charter schools in standardized testing when he was, you know, the chief of Chicago and Philadelphia public schools and also of the Recovery School District in Louisiana. You know, there was also a minor divide about crime. I don't know if that was especially important. There was only 800 to 1,000 cops who threatened to resign if Brandon Johnson won the mayoralty, which of course that ultimately ended up being mocked by leftists online who saw that. And after Brandon Johnson's victory, they were waiting on those cops to resign. But also before we leave here, as we've just eclipsed the hour mark here, there was a state representative by the name of Teresa Ma, Illinois state representative. She was speaking at an event for Brandon Johnson just a couple of days before the mayoral election. And she attacked Paul Vallis for essentially being unable to distinguish between herself and now Cook County Commissioner Yosina Morita. Both of them have Chinese American ancestry while the two were working on Pat Quinn's 2014 gubernatorial campaign. If you'll remember, Paul Vallis was the lieutenant gubernatorial nominee for Pat Quinn. And so essentially that was attacking Vallis as being essentially racist against Asian people, particularly those of Chinese descent, which it's hard to compound given, you know, the fact that Chinese voters in Chinatown went predominantly for Paul Vallis, the incumbent alderwoman Nicole Lee, who won a runoff against a more conservative candidate. She endorsed Paul Vallis in the runoff. She ended up winning her own runoff by about 34 points. But there is that element to it as well. There is also, like I said earlier, a Harold Washington element to it. Brandon Johnson was often compared to Harold Washington by progressives who saw him as sort of Washington's modern version, essentially. There was this whole talk about a rainbow coalition, you know, getting together black voters, Asian voters, Latinas, you know, and white progressives over to vote for him and propel him to the mayoralty. And that's more or less what happened if you take out like a majority of Latinas. Like, it wasn't much that Paul Vallis won them by. I think it was by 55-45, 60-40, that sort of split. But that essentially happened. The Rainbow Coalition happened again. And with the general progressive victories in the city council runoffs, there was another member of Chicago's Democratic Socialists of America chapter that won election to the city council. Now there are 7 socialist city aldermen. And with the other progressive wins, like in the 48th ward in the north side, Brandon Johnson was able to carry Lenny Mona Hoppenworth to victory over Joe Dunn, a more moderate candidate. Mona Hoppenworth becomes the first Filipina American to be ever elected to, I think, any Illinois state office, or any Illinois office, particularly Chicago's Board of Aldermen. And she is going to be seen as an ally of Brandon Johnson. Now, you know, what Brandon Johnson will be able to do on his agenda is going to be another story, but that's another story for potentially another episode and maybe another season. The final thing I do want to go over before ending this podcast, which I know has been dragging on a little bit, but there is a massive, massive, massive tough on crime narrative that, you know, I saw, at least sort of my reaction, like these are only my opinions. I saw local media was completely in Paul Vallis' corner because he was a tough on crime candidate, and, you know, you know, the newspapers, like especially like the Chicago Tribune, whose editorial board endorsed him, was going all in on the crime narrative, saying that Brandon Johnson would be a disaster for the city of Chicago. But I do think that it is hard to sort of, you know, conceive that, while at the same time, the areas where there is the highest crime in Chicago, which are predominantly black wards, voted overwhelmingly for Brandon Johnson. And the media, the other reason why I say media was in the tank for Paul Ballas. Again, this is not, you know, sober electoral analysis. These are just my opinions, my reactions to the races I was watching it unfold. Like during the day of the elections, as the results were coming in, Paul Vallis was in the lead. But then, you know, sort of the later ballots came in and Brandon Johnson ended up pulling ahead. The Chicago Tribune definitely did not take that well, because the editorial board wrote an article that was titled "Brandon Johnson made a reference to," like, I'm paraphrasing here, "Brandon Johnson mentioned God in his speech, but he did not mention Barack Obama," which I found absolutely hilarious, because the former president did not endorse in the runoff. Like, he could have endorsed Vallis, he could have endorsed Johnson, but Barack Obama chose to stay neutral in that race. So I found it hard to believe that Brandon Johnson, the now mayor-elect of Chicago, owed the former president anything when the former president never endorsed his candidacy. So now Brandon Johnson has been elected mayor of Chicago with, you know, support from black voters, you know, North Side progressives, you know, from South Asians and from, you know, many Latinas, including Puerto Ricans and Mexicans in Chuy Garcia's, home base. It's sort of the base for Chuy Garcia's machine that he's been trying to establish for years. So that concludes the first episode of Pulse of the Nation. We'll be doing this every week. We'll be recording every Thursday. You know, most times I will be recording these individually, but sometimes I may bring on a guest. On my next episode, I will give a little teaser to the next episode. Next episode, I'll be focusing solely on the 2024 presidential race, the candidates that are running, which candidates on the Republican and Democratic side I think have a chance at becoming president, which ones I think whose candidacies are laughable, and what could be the impact should certain things happen in the presidential race. That concludes episode 1 of Pulse of the Nation. Thank y'all for listening to this hour-long diatribe about elections that happened hundreds of miles outside of the state of Alabama. And I swear, these do have national implications. Like in Wisconsin, like you will have probably two extra Democratic House representatives. There'll be a net change of 4, 2 losses for Republicans, 2 gains for Democrats, and that could be absolutely massive in determining control of the House in 2024. And for Chicago's mayoral election, I especially wanted to highlight this because, you know, it is, I believe, the 3rd or 4th biggest city in the United States of America. It is, you know, when people think of the Midwest, they think of Chicago. I know a lot of UA students are either from Chicago or near Chicago. So I thought it would be nice to highlight that race. And if there are any national implications, I'm not sure. You know, if there are any, if there are any national implications, I don't think the mainstream media will learn, because they're going, I believe at least, that they're going to sort of continue the whole, you have to be tough on crime narrative, you have to hire more police, and you know, yada, yada, yada. But that's another topic for another day. Thank you for tuning in, and I will see y'all next week with a discussion on the 2024 presidential race.
WVUA-FM, Tuscaloosa.